might change people's views not only on technology, but also what we consider central to our lives. For example, what do people think about the concept of a relationship or friendship? And I think these concepts will change, and this will happen during my lifetime, so I'm more concerned about that. I'm more concerned about looking at humans, looking at people, also potentially vulnerable people who are being exposed to this type of technology, and I would generally advocate that robots need to be just clearly, show and demonstrate what they are and what they can do and what they can't do. Because otherwise there's a big confusion on how a robot might look like, how it can behave, and what it can actually do. And that can give rise to quite a lot of misunderstandings or even problems. Last but not least, as far as I'm concerned, robots are machines. Full stop. Interesting machines, it's fun working with them, fun interacting with them, but and actually machines that may be quite useful for us. I really feel that. Let me show you a video. Let's go back 40 years. Volume was okay. It seems somebody has turned down the volume, but even without listening, I think that you saw what the vision was. So this robot, this housemaid for only 500 pounds, well, I think at that time the pound was worth a bit more, but still 500 pounds. So let me now show you a very recent video, another video about what, and that's portraying...
That's why I'm taking the robot can interact with us. It's been created by scientists in Hertfordshire using humans to teach it to behave properly.
Should have a name. It's in its very early stages at the moment. But Kate Pratt went to Hatfield to find out more.
Hello there, how are you?
Is this the brightest robot ever? Designed at the University of Hertfordshire as part of the Cod Neuron project, I can make you a cuppa and even join the conversation.
Well, thank you. Well, it's not just for lazy people like me that this can really work. Imagine how useful it can be for the elderly or people with disabilities who want to carry on living in their home. Cheers.
And the difference between this robot and, say, a Dalek is that it's been taught manners.
Imagine you had such a machine in your house and it might be able to do useful tasks for you, but it does it in a way that is simply annoying you. What you want is a robot that has manners, that has a certain way how to behave itself. In the same way as other family members or your friends, they would not interrupt you when they see, oh, you are very, very busy doing something else.
But would you really want a robot as a companion? Well, funnily, all the male students we spoke to at the university said they'd love one.
In cookie dinner? Yeah, I'll just step out all the time. I don't know, if I got lonely, maybe I have a bit of company. It gets cold a little bit like that.
Do the dishes, I don't know, some of Sanders would be good as well, isn't it?
Clean a lot and everything. Assignments without a doubt. I just get first class degree first. Forget my robot to do it, excuse me.
A robot that can interact socially is still some way off, but the team here are certainly at the forefront of the technology.
Well, obviously, this robot's very capable of many things, but the good thing is, we all know they'll never replace humans.
So I just wanted to show you that this notion of a robot companion has been around for a long time. And sometimes people ask me, well, you're still working on it? Don't you know already how to build this robot that does the dishes at the household? And the answer is no. This involves very, very severe robotics, technical problems. It's still, you know, cutting-edge research to build such a robot that can actually be in your house and do useful things. Note, when I mean companion, I mean a robot that can do a variety of tasks. Of course, you can already buy robots that are very limited, say, just doing the vacuuming, or just doing, you know, a particular task. But this notion, and I think in the Able-Mable vision, this was very, very clear, this kind of companion that, you know, can help you in lots of ways. This is still very much in the future. Another thing you need to be careful about is when somebody uses the word social in the context of a robot, what do you actually mean? I could list a slide with 20 definitions of what this means in the literature, in the field. Just two of them, just the two ends of a whole spectrum. Some people would call a robot social evocative in the way that it would evoke people's tendency to anthropomorphize it, regardless of what the robot is actually doing or whether it moves at all. People would just look at it and say, oh, it's cute, I'd like to have it. On the other end of the spectrum, more the AI perspective, where people actually worry about the models of intelligence and social competence that this robot needs to have. And of course, in between, you have this whole range of how much intelligence does the robot have, and how much of social behavior also depends on having the human in the human actually interacting with that system. And three more concepts. I mean, what you also need, in the literature, for example, people may emphasize, for example, one of these aspects, either the AI or robot cognition center view, where people are really, really worried, you know, of how can we build this perfect AI architecture, the more robot-centered view, which is looking at the robot as a creature on its own. That's maybe a little bit more related to the first talk, where you have this robot as maybe, you know, an animal-like system or a human-like system that has its needs, its desires, its emotions, and that these needs need to be fulfilled. So this is more the robot as a creature viewpoint. And the other viewpoint that's more what we are pursuing in is more this human-centered viewpoint to see, okay, we cannot look at this robot in isolation, we need to look at the social context. We need to bring people in, we need to ask people, we need to let them participate in the design and in the evaluation of these systems. So I just briefly want to mention that, you know, when you hear people talk about, oh, social robots and, you know, what they might actually mean in a particular context might, you know, very, very different from another context. Like, if you just look at the whole range of possible applications, clearly, if you send a robot down to the sewage system to maybe clean the sewage system, you know, it might not need any skills to interact with people at all, which is very, very different from, say, applications of robots in therapy or rehabilitation. I will give an example of that later. So again, there is no one social robot. There is no fixed definition of what that means. It depends on what are the requirements and what are the needs of people in particular application areas. And if it comes to, for example, nursing care or rehabilitation or also a companion in the home, then clearly the social behavior of the robot is not only just an interesting add-on, like, oh, wouldn't it be cute if it could talk, but it's an inherent part of its functionality. If the robot cannot properly interact and communicate with people, it would throw it out. Imagine you spent a lot of money on a intelligent robot, you buy it via Amazon, the big package comes to your house, you open the big package, you switch it on, you know, well, it might take some time until it boots, but anyway, then it moves around. You find it interesting, sort of, you know, but then, say for example, it says to you every morning when you wake up, it says to you exactly the same thing. Would you like to offer you a cup of coffee? The first thing you think, oh great, excellent. The next thing you think, okay. After a month, you think, no, don't talk, just stay there. Just because there's more to social behavior and communication than this notion of, oh, it needs to talk, it needs to know where people are. No, there's a whole range of politeness and knowing norms, knowing when people might be tired, like when we've just woken up, you know, then please don't annoy people. So these are all different application areas like as I said, a robot in the sewage system on the one hand, and a robot, you know, in rehabilitation care or care for the elderly on the other hand. So you need to look at all of these dimensions in order to determine what type of social behavior do you want. Now, Rachel already indicated this, report where it was suggested that robots, should be granted robot rights. This can, of course, be addressed in a very deep way, like what the other speakers at this symposium are doing, and it's very much appreciated. But as Rachel also said, you might just look at it from a very superficial point of view. And then it's very much like a discussion that I don't find that useful. It is the more this kind of scheme, if the robot has emotions, then, I shouldn't treat it badly. If the robot ever becomes conscious, I need to treat it like a person. So, we need to really think more deeply about what the other notions are. So I appreciate the other speakers in this symposium. Again, I have a more practical point of view. I'm not concerned about the robots that we have right now. So one of the robots that we have right now, which is relevant to this discussion, are humanoids. Because the researchers in that report, primarily have in mind those robots that can do more human-like thing. And that's a robot that we built in our group that has some human-like expressions, like it has facial expressions, eyelids, it can move the neck, it can move the arms. It was primarily built for interaction with people. So here you just see a little bit more the kind of design. What is important is here that we were not trying to actually replicate the human being. We call it a minimal design. We just took some of the features and then deliberately kept the appearance of the robot as a robot. For example, what you can see here, it would have been very easy for us just to cover up the neck where the wires stick out, or at the wrists you have the same thing. But we didn't do it because we wanted people to see at first glance, this is a machine, this is a robot. But of course, a robot with certain features, and many people these days are using such kind of robots, like robots that can express gestures, whether you label them with some emotions or not. These are not emotions, these are simply labels that we use in order to characterize these expressions. So one of the thought experiments, this is why I say sometimes this debate, if it's not done in a deeper sense, then it can end up like, in our university, for example, we have a nursery. So I had the thought at some point that I mentioned to my students, well, what if we, if we complete an application form, Casper to go to the nursery? And of course, whatever the outcome would be, if the application would be rejected or it would be accepted, it would be a great story for us to work with. But again, this is not really useful. It would be completely besides the point, since the reality is, although we gave it certain features that people can interact with this robot in a more human-like way to a certain extent, this robot is a machine. It smiles because we tell it to smile, and whether it's a neural network or some other algorithm that makes it smile, whether we can predict it at this moment in time or not, we make it smile. So Casper definitely, and all the robots that we have these days, they do not have a life, or they're not sentient beings. The previous speaker talked a lot about sentience, so Casper is not a sentient being. And if a great school was thrown away and built a new one, actually that built a new one in the meantime. But the first Casper is still there. It's still functioning. So of course, this has to be separated from the notion that somebody might be fond of Casper, in the same way that somebody might be fond of a porcelain figure or a car or a nice laptop. They might be attached to it in a certain way, but if my laptop that I'm attached to, because it's reliable, if it breaks, I throw it away and buy a new one. So this is different from what that laptop actually is. So we need to separate between, in the case of these humanoids that we have, what they actually are, namely machines, and the way that people might view them. But people will still know these are machines. So the fact that people do treat computers and lots of other interactive technology, including robots, that they treat these objects socially, this tells us actually more about the nature of being a sentient being and being human, but nothing about the nature of the objects themselves. So the fact that people treat Casper socially doesn't make Casper social. It just tells us that this is the way how people respond to interactive technology, and these two things don't need to be confused. But again, at the practical meaning of these robots now. What is an open issue is, if this goes further, in particular if it involves vulnerable people like elderly or people with special needs, if, for example, robots may be used, and this may happen in my lifetime, so I am very concerned about that, if they may be used, if robots may be used to, you know, care for them, then, you know, there are many positive aspects to that, but there's also a lot of dangers in what type of relationship would people develop to this machine, and would it in their minds still be possible to separate what these machines are, namely machines that you can actually switch off or replace, and what they may receive? Because if you long term interact with such pieces of technology, then you might develop a different type of relationship. And this was also put very nicely by Falk in an article in 1999. He called this type of, he was more concerned about digital pets, but these companions, or like these Casper robots, are the same. These are products, pieces of computer technology that were specifically designed for the purpose to create relationships with people, as opposed to other machines that are primarily just tools that increase your abilities, or like virtual environments, a medium that gives you some experience. But this is something quite concerning for me, that very often these artifacts give the illusion that they respond, that they return to you things in the same way as if you are in a relationship with another human or with a pet, where you get something back, where you emotionally get something back. And so just in terms of why do people use humanoids, actually, I just wanted to show that even in the 16th, 17th century, people built these human-like figures, and this hasn't changed. So one of the first humanoids that Toyota came up with was the trumpet player. You know, people have just always been fascinated over centuries, or thousands of years actually, this goes back a long time, to create things that show some human-like properties. And one interesting suggestion here that in the 1950s, published in that article, that a roboticist in Japan always suggested it's this uncanny valley, meaning that if you make these robots, these machines, more and more human-like, then people, you know, like them more and more, they're more and more familiar to them, until it reaches a point that is the uncanny valley, where something is wrong, where you have this repulsive effect. Of course, once you go into the future, and these machines will become indistinguishable from human beings, well, then if you don't know it's a machine, then of course you will treat it like a human being. But, I mean, this is a fiction. This area of the uncanny valley is fiction. This is more reality. These are the systems we have now, and some groups are pushing towards, you know, one-to-one similarity with humans, and this is androids. Most machines are still on the level of mechanistic appearances or more cartoon-like appearances, anthropomorphic ones. This is just an example I wanted to show. It is not a robot. These are dolls, and I learned that they are very famous collectible items that you might pay a lot of money for. And what is a bit, and I think it doesn't matter whether you have children or not, I just ask you, look at these pictures, look at the realism that people went through in making these dolls. This is a new kind of doll. This is not the typical doll. These are, you know, I mean, so, most people I talk to, they feel really, really funny, including myself. And this is exactly what Moe, if it were a robot, they would call, this is hitting the uncanny valley. So unless you are a collector and you really collect these things, and you put them, in your home you have a cot for babies and you put that doll in there, then you know. But most people I know, they have some problems with such kind of dolls. And because again, I think there is a level of detail where actually these dolls, I think, look more like corpses. Anyway, I found this just interesting to mention, because similarly, a couple of companies have tried to produce robot babies so they could really move but not on that level of detail. But again, they were not that much of a success because people are so sensitive. I mean, here from the appearance, you might really be fooled. I mean, if I had told you this is a doll, you might believe, oh, this is a real baby. But as soon as you have, if this, you know, if you make this into a ball and it moves, of course, you would see after a split second, oh, that's not what a baby does. But I mean, people are pushing this frontier really quite seriously. In the case of Android, Hiroshi Ishiguro's lab in Osaka, in Japan, and so they are really seeing these robots as also models that might be useful for people in cognitive science to probe and to test some of the models that they have on human cognition and human intelligence, using this robot as a test bed. It's a more biologically inspired viewpoint, if you like. But still, people find it quite unsettling to a certain extent. And at the moment, these machines do fall severely into the uncanny valley. Even their designers say, well, you might be fooled for a split second when you see the robot, say you have a curtain, the curtain goes back, you know, for a couple of seconds, you might think, oh, there's a human being there, there's a Japanese woman standing there. But as soon as the robot starts moving, then, well, you'll see, okay, something is odd, something is wrong, that's a robot. So, I mean, this is kind of, you know, people really trying to push this field into exactly copying human-like appearance and behavior, but most systems are more on the level like what I showed you. They have some human-like features, but they don't even try to pretend that they are human-like. So one of the things that concerns me, and also Sherry Turkle, she wrote an article about this in a recent special issue of the Journal of Interactive Study. She said, with these new relational artifacts, as she calls them, so as I said before, machines that pretend you can have a real relationship with them, what is more concerning with them, that on the level of understanding, they are still on the level of, say, you know, 6 years ago, Eliza, so a system, an AI system, an early AI system, but still it gave the impression it could understand you. If you wrote something, you know, that you're troubled, that you're sad, then it would say, I understand. And it also, you know, was able to respond in some reasonable way. And this is similar with these relational artifacts that we have. And the danger is that people, you know, they're specifically designed to make people feel understood, but they're still without understanding. I think that's the perfect way how to say it, and this is why I quote Sherry Turkle, because I couldn't say it better than she does. And she also says that ultimately, when, for example, children or people, you know, begin to love their robots, like their robot pets, it is not so much a question, you know, whether they love their robots like other animals or not. It is more what this concept of love will become, what this will mean to people. So if you have the illusion to have a relationship with a machine where you can easily press the pause button, very practical. So if you have a big argument and you just pause, I think all of you understand, you can remember situations where you just wish a human being had a pause button, because, you know, just give me a break, just a second. Then, of course, this changes what you might also prefer. And Sherry goes on to say, well, is there a probability that human relationships will just seem too hard? Because as we all know, they are hard. They are lovely, they are rewarding and nice, but they are hard. Not all the time, but, you know, as I said, humans don't have a pause button. They don't have a reset. They don't have a way to be reprogrammed. You cannot change their appearance if you don't like how they look. All that is possible, of course, with robots. So in a more general sense, you know, what will be the value, as Sherry Turkle continues, what will be the value of interactions that contain no understanding of us, that are only pretending, and that contributes nothing to a shared store of human meaning? So, like her, I don't have an answer to that, but this is, I mean, despite the fact that I'm often very critical about, you know, debates on, you know, how intelligent I am, this is something I am concerned from a human-robot interaction perspective. What will this mean to have people long-term repeatedly interacting with machines that pretend you can have a relationship with them? How will it change the people? So, let me just move on. And not surprisingly, the way that we interact with anything, even moving circles, I don't want to go into detail, but it was a very interesting experiment. Even if you ask people, what do you perceive? And you see just the shapes moving on the screen, people will tell you stories about humans and or agents, and you know. So it is our nature, and that has to do with our evolutionary origins. It has to do with our social nature. And Alison Jolly, I mean, last year there was a symposium at the Royal Society about the 50th anniversary of the social intelligence hypothesis, and Alison Jolly studied Linnaeus, non-human primates, and she was the first suggesting that the origin of primate intelligence, and we are also primates, that so the origin of our intelligence is social. So we first became social beings, and I'll simplify very much, you can ask me details later. We first became social beings according to this hypothesis that many of the other people since then have been writing about. We became intelligent because we were reusing skills that we had developed as social beings. So it's a very good story of that. So this is why we behave towards artifacts like that, a very famous artifact, Cynthia Riesel, you know, one of the first of these interactive human-like artifacts that give the impression they understand you, not verbally but non-verbally, and give the illusion you can have a relationship with them. Although this robot did not learn anything, it didn't have any learning in there, actually. But it was controlled by a quite sophisticated network of internal variables that had to do with the social drive and the internal variables regarding emotions that were modeled. So I don't want to explain it. I just want to show you that this was an example of what I would call caretaker paradigm, where humans are being put into the position of caring for a robot, like you would care for a child or for a dog. So robots are being considered as a baby. So Kismet only worked if you interacted with it as if it were a child. It didn't say anything if you just wanted to talk to it, you know, like an adult conversation, it wouldn't. You know, it was tuned, it was designed to tune in on certain factors. And that's, of course, a fact that also in comics and animation people have been exploiting, that if you make things so cute, if you give them baby-like features, then it triggers the nurturing instinct in people, regardless of, you know, young, old man, woman. If people see something, you know, it's kind of caring, then it elicits certain instinctive tendencies in us. The normal tendencies, let me phrase it like that, would be to care for, to nurture, you know, this this thing. Now, this is a little bit different from the companion paradigm, which is more the kind of thing that myself and others in the field are pursuing, where we say, well, rather than thinking of robots taking care of people, or people taking care of people, of robots, sorry, why don't we worry about how robots might take care of people? So it's the robot's job to find out what you want, rather than your job to find out how can I make this robot happy. So the companion metaphor that we have, that we expect at the beginning of my talk, so, well, it has to be useful, it's not just for entertaining, it can do certain jobs for you, but it has to do it in a way that is acceptable to you. And there are, of course, many issues involved in how can a robot be considerate, unintrusive, how, you know, can it be taught manners. These are very, very hard issues from a robotics, from an interaction design point of view. And one example of a project that I'd like to mention is this project where we, Aurora, and also a recent project, European project, iRomac, where we investigate robots as possible tools for children with autism. There are potentially many ways in how people might use robots for children with autism, like as a tool for psychologists or as a diagnostic tool, but our focus is more the robot as a mediator. So we take the fact that the children are very interested in the robot and we put it in a social context where other people are present, other children, and our work focuses on how can the robot be mediated between that child. Children with autism have specific impairments in communication, interaction, and imagination and fantasy, so it's very hard for them to interact socially with people, but we exploit the fact they are like any other children, you know, they are quite fond of the robot, and so we create scenarios where they mediate. And there's quite a lot of work in that area. related work. So the starting point is that social interaction for men appears very overwhelming. Robots can provide a safe, predictable, and enjoyable environment. So we emphasize play. The children play with the robot, but they play with it in a social context, as you can see here. And that's the kind of work that we have been doing. Of course, the play perspective is because play is extremely important, not only for intellectual, but also social development and emotional development. And it is fun. We must not forget that if we work with vulnerable people, there are really issues. And we try to create scenarios where the children, in the first place, enjoy the interaction with the robot. And then we take this as a step to say, okay, how can we look at some therapeutic or educational aspects in there? So we are working with different designs of robots, like this mobile robot that you can see here. But I also like to come back and just go on. Now, I mean, there are some, from robotics, from an experimental point of view, doing this type of work is very, very different from other work, like we're working with small user groups. We need to be very concerned about robustness and safety of the robots, but also the quality of life and ethical issues. Like, we cannot just say, okay, we want to do this experiment, we need this number of subjects, so let's just work with them. It doesn't work like that. So we collaborate, for example, with different schools. We work with small groups of children. We look at their individual characteristics and likes and dislikes, and we need to design the trials so that they get something out of it, that it's worthwhile for them doing it. So you cannot just, you know, have hundreds of children being exposed to that robot and then do some great statistics. It doesn't work like that. It's more long-term. It's more on the level of case studies. So we want the children to be comfortable with this interaction and to get something out of it. So we had some quite encouraging results in that respect. I don't want to go into too much detail. What is important, or what was important for us, is also to compare the robots we have with other toys in order to show that children interact differently to the robot in a more social way. And that's what we also confirmed. I don't have time to show you videos about that. But again, you know, the main emphasis is on the mediation.
Meet Casper the robot.
Let me just show this.
Simple toys could make a big difference to some young lives. Autistic children like Joey don't interact well with others, but watch how he copies the robot's simple movements. It's a small step towards learning how to play with other children. The doctor who played with Casper Expert also opened up to his inventor.
That was the most promising point to see that because of the robot, they start interacting with other human being. Because in the end of the day, I don't want to encourage just relationship with a machine. I want to, my interest is to encourage interaction with other humans, other children.
The robot isn't totally lifelike, and it's been designed like that on purpose. Autistic children often have trouble reading all the subtle expressions in the human face. So the robot's been kept very simple to encourage the children to look him in the eye and interact with him.
And that's exactly what the children have been doing, to the delight of their carers.
It's lovely to see the youngsters interacting with us, and then looking around and sharing that joy and saying, it's almost as if, have you seen that? You see what he's just done? And it's, that's very exciting.
And the team behind Kinder Casper are working on other robots. This one was designed to encourage turn-taking.
Okay, I just stopped here. I just wanted to show you just an example of how children actually interact with the robot. And this is why I say, despite my often critical remarks, I do think robots can be useful. You can. There is a great potential in using the interactive skills of robots in very targeted applications. Again, the reason why we emphasize human-human interaction is, as far as I'm concerned, any interaction with a robot is mechanical interaction. There's no meaning in it. I'm a robotics researcher. I'm supposed to be enthusiastic about robots, but I'm sorry. For me, interacting with a robot is meaningless unless it's in a context where the context provides the meaning to it. I'm sorry for disappointing. So again, I emphasize this mediation aspect you've already seen. This is, of course, work, you know, that is very long-term, where we need to go for longitudinal studies. We cannot just ask the children for direct feedback. We need to be really, really careful, as I said, in how to fit in the work, the schedule of the school, to collaborate with the teachers, and so on. Now, the other example, I already mentioned it, about the work we have on robot companions. And that's just one last video I want to show.
So how does it define human-robot interactions? We need to know exactly what people are actively disliking.
Okay.
This trial aims to explore some important aspects of human preferences towards different robot appearances.
So let me actually, since I'm running out of time, let me show you this video instead. Sorry. So this was an experiment we did in our robot house, the University of Carthage robot house, which is just like a normal flat that we decorated a bit like a living room. We are measuring, for example, distances, how should the robot approach people. We're using different visual cues. Showing what kind of experiments we're really doing in the robot house to think about these very practical issues. Again, I would call this confidentiality of information a practical issue. Potentially, if you have a robot in your house, it will know everything about you, who your friends are, what you say to your friends, who your partners are, what arguments you have with them, what you eat, what you drink, anything. How often you call your mother or not. And you know, these are issues now. You will have these systems in your house and, you know, in the next few years. But these are issues that you can experimentally study. And so I very much appreciate also input from people from other communities who are philosophical or other types of backgrounds. Because there is a need to do these studies now. I don't want to have robots in the house in 10 years' time. And then we discover, oh, actually people are very uncomfortable if the robot can register when they take a phone call. We should probably have an option where you can switch that off. Usually people first develop technology, then they use some people, then they discover what they need to change. But some other people are really trying to do these studies now and hopefully to inform what can be done. So let me just see what else there's left. I already mentioned most of these things. What is maybe interesting to mention is that these views that people have and preferences that they have on, you know, whether should the robot look human-like or mechanical, that we also found it depends on personality traits. So for example, whether somebody is more extroverted or more introverted, this will influence the kind of preferences. So for us, this is a lesson that we also need to personalize these robots. We cannot just let loose one robot that fits all. We need to really look at individual people, what they want, their preferences. Like, for example, do they want the robot to know what they're doing 24 hours, 7 days a week? Some people are. Some people don't mind having a video camera in their bathroom that broadcasts live on the internet. Fine, they can, you know, they can have a different setting from myself, maybe. I maybe wouldn't want to have a, you know. So I already mentioned these type of issues that are involved, the evaluation of interactions, looking at the design space of robots. And just for maybe some of you have a background in human-computer interaction, where people talk a lot about usability. As I said, very often you develop a product, and then you test it with people to see how easy can they learn the interface, how efficient is the new product. But this is very different from what you need to do with these robots, where they actually proactively interact with people, not just people interact with them. They interact with people, they learn, they may portray a personality. So then you're asking different questions suddenly, like how satisfying is the experience? How much fun is it? How helpful is it? And I would add the point also, how authentic is the relationship? So is the robot pretending that something is there that actually isn't? Is it pretending that it remembers you, but actually it doesn't? you know. It just knows tricks and how to pretend these things. So again, this goes back to what I discussed, you know, the views that Sherry Turkle and I share about, you know, we need to look at this issue of authentic experience with robots. And again, that was my slide. Actually, I'm able to show it. It's fantastic. I'm able to show my very last slide, but you've already heard it in the beginning of my talk. So I'm more concerned, again, I'm not so much concerned about robots, I'm concerned about people. I'm concerned about what concepts like love and relationship and trust will become in interactions with these people, that will be the interactions with these robots that will be there in the next 10, 20 years, so in the more short terms. And again, robots are machines, robots we have now that will have in the future. They're not sentient beings, but you might be able to use them for something useful. Thank you.